From WBUR in Boston, I'm Bill Littlefield, and this is NPR's Only a Game. 30 bowl games down. Mercifully, there are only four more to go. Ahead on Only a Game, a BCS championship preview and a look at the NFL's wild card weekend. Also, a report from Portland where the Trailblazers are finding new ways to win and to win over fans, and the best sports writing of 2008. Also ahead, everyone wins, students, professors, and athletic rodents at the Extreme Rat Challenge.
We see the challenges of learning, the challenges of training, you know, the heartbreak that can come when they don't do it, when you know they can. Remember, that's how your professors feel when we see these scores sometimes. We go, no, we know they know this stuff. What's going on here?
Stay tuned. This is Only a Game. I'm Bill Littlefield, and so we come to the favorite weekend of many fans of football, the first weekend of NFL playoff games, 2 days and nights during which it will be all football all the time, except when it's pregame guessing and postgame analysis. Take heart, baseball fans, next month pitchers and catchers report. But in the meantime, I'm joined by Matt Crossman of the Sporting News for an intrepid plunge into wild card weekend. Matt, welcome back to Only a Game.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm ready to dive right in.
I'm glad to hear it. The story of Wild Card Weekend, I suppose, is the San Diego Chargers, who at 8-8 must feel at least a little bit sheepish about the fact that their mediocre record earned them the right to host the 12-4 Colts. Does San Diego stand any chance against Indianapolis?
I certainly think they do. They earned that 8-8 record, but they're a much better team than that. And Indy's playing great, too. But I mean, if you look at San Diego's talent, especially on offense, you know, they've got a top quarterback, a running back who admittedly had a tough season, but is still one of the better running backs in the league and the best tight end in the league. That's certainly not going to be a walk for either team. That's going to be a good game.
In the earlier game today, the 9-7 Arizona Cardinals face the Atlanta Falcons. Which team prevails in that ornithological matchup? That's funny. See, ornithological and birds. See?
Yeah, I was going to say that matchup's for the birds. I got to go with Atlanta on that for a couple of reasons. Even though it's in Arizona, the playoffs are often about running, and they're the best running team in the league, and the Cardinals are the worst. And the Cardinals, you know, if anyone should feel sheepish, in addition to the Chargers, should be the Cardinals, because they just sort of wallowed into the playoffs, losing three in a row badly, and the Falcons are the hot team. Now, they're pretty young, and Arizona isn't, but Arizona doesn't have any playoff experience either, so I think I would lean towards the Falcons on that one.
Does that wallowing explain why the last time I looked, good seats were still available in Arizona for that game?
Yeah, that and the fact that it's in Arizona, because last I checked, Arizona sports fans don't understand a sport if the ball doesn't have dimples on it. so I would go with that.
In the early game tomorrow, Miami hosts Baltimore. Quoth the Dolphin, nevermore?
Boy, that's a tough matchup. Miami easily and far and away the surprise team of the year, you know, winning 11 games a year after they only won one. And Baltimore, probably the least known 11-5 team this year, always good to punch someone in the mouth with their defense. So I guess I would go with Baltimore because defense wins games like this. But, you know, that's a matchup of 2-11-5 teams. That's a great first-round game.
You mentioned the turnaround in Miami. How much credit does Bill Parcells get for that?
Probably too much. I didn't see Bill Parcells put on a helmet, and I didn't see him put on any shoulder pads. Certainly he got the guys who did that, but, you know, when a coach gets fired, the players will say, I didn't see him out there dropping passes or throwing interceptions. General manager's even farther removed. So he gets some, but any more than some is too much.
Later on Sunday, Minnesota will host Philadelphia. Does the Vikings' 10-6 record provide a morale boost over the paltry 9-6-1 Eagles?
Well, it'd be interesting to see what Donovan McNabb's answer would be if you asked him what, you know, if they had the same record, whether that constitutes a tie and what happens after that. I think this game is pretty widely seen as Philadelphia's to lose. 9-6-1 in the NFC East is way, way better than 10-6 in the NFC North. I mean, they had to beat the Cowboys and the Redskins and the Giants to do that. Minnesota had to beat Green Bay, Chicago, and the lack of an NFL team in Detroit. So I would give the edge to Philly there.
The New England Patriots did not make the playoffs this year despite their 11-5 record, a better record than four of the teams that will be playing this weekend, and as good as those of three others alive in the postseason. Is this a good enough argument that the league needs to revamp its playoff system?
I don't think so. I think part of the reason teams will have fewer wins is that their conference, or their division, I should say, is that much better. Look at Philadelphia. They're 9-6 because the Cowboys and the Giants and the Redskins are all playoff-caliber teams, and so you're going to lose some of those games. And I hear people say that all the time, but I don't see what the possible solution is. What, then you do some kind of a weird seeding thing? Well, I just don't see that as viable either, because then you'd have a team like the Chargers. They won their division, and they don't make the playoffs. That makes less sense. I mean, you have divisions for a reason. The winner of each division absolutely has to make the playoffs. I don't see any way around that.
Matt, we would be remiss, I think, if we were to neglect to mention this season's only perfect team. That, of course, is the Detroit Lions. They became the first team in NFL history to go 0-16. How will you remember the 2008 Lions?
I will remember them for ruining yet another Thanksgiving. I am from Detroit. I grew up in the suburbs and spent the first 20-some-odd years of my life there celebrating Thanksgiving by watching them. And then I got married to a woman who doesn't understand football, doesn't understand that you have to watch football between 12 and 3 and thus can't eat dinner. But now I have to stop watching the game at like 1:30. So my argument for a later dinner, I now lose because I don't care about the football games anymore.
The argument for stopping at 1:30 being because you can't stand it anymore?
It's like watching a car accident. It's horrible. And I think that's true for people who didn't grow up there, too, for people who don't care. You want to at least be entertained, and they're just not. And I'm not one who's going to argue that they should lose that game, and I will admit because I'm a little bit biased, but certainly – if I'm the NFL, I'm thinking Thanksgiving is a time for me to absolutely showcase my product, and for it to be such a clunker year in and year out, that's not good. You know, the NFL is all about protecting the shield. That's really not good for the shield.
Matt Grossman writes for the Sporting News, and he joins me from time to time to talk pro football as well. Thanks, Matt.
Thanks for having me.
The Portland Trail Blazers beat the defending champion Boston Celtics on Tuesday night, and they are currently battling for the top spot in the NBA's Northwest Division. The Blazers haven't qualified for the playoffs since 2003 and have endured recent seasons in which the team garnered more attention for player misbehavior than for on-court success. But as Only a Game's Sadie Babbitts reports, Portland fans are swarming back to see just how far this young team will go.
It's early in the first quarter of the Portland Trail Blazers game last month against the Sacramento Kings. The Rose Garden Arena is packed with some 20,000 Blazers fans eager to see their team snap a three-game losing streak, including an overtime loss to the lowly Los Angeles Clippers. After a close first quarter, the Blazers sharpen their focus and tighten up their defense. By the second quarter, the Blazers have a solid lead over the Kings as Portland goes on to win 109-77. But Blazers fans are just as excited about what the Blazers are doing off the court as on it.
The real crux of why this city is so passionate about this group is because it was so bad for so long.
That's Isaac Ropp. He hosts a weekday afternoon AM radio sports show in Portland. He's been covering the Blazers for 7 years.
Had it been pretty good all the way along, this is just another, you know, good young team that the city really likes. But what makes it special is that this city really was tortured with this group. I mean, it was laughable. They were a joke. They were laughingstock of sports.
That joke started in the late 90s when Portland general manager Bob Whitson had carte blanche to get the best basketball players around. But according to Ropp, Whitsitt didn't take into account what kind of players he was bringing to the team.
And before you know it, the Blazers had guys who were getting in fights in practice with one another. You had a convicted rapist on the team. You had guys busted repeatedly for marijuana. You had players flipping off fans.
The sex scandals, infighting, and fines for illegal gun possession didn't go over well with diehard fans who nicknamed the team the Jailblazers. Rob says they stopped going to the games, and suddenly team owner Paul Allen was losing hundreds of millions of dollars. General manager Bob Whitsitt resigned, and he was replaced by John Nash. And by 2004, some serious rearranging was underway. According to the NBA, the Trailblazers ranked the lowest of the NBA's 30 teams in total attendance for the 2005-2006 season. Paul Allen put the team on the market briefly in 2006, but later that year he changed his mind. That year, the Blazers drafted forward LaMarcus Aldridge and guards Brandon Roy and Sergio Rodriguez. And in 2007, they selected center Greg Oden with the number one pick.
Brandon Roy, two shots.
Brandon Roy is averaging 23 points and about 5 rebounds and 5 assists per game this season. In mid-December, he scored 52 points against the Phoenix Suns, setting a Rose Garden record. Against Sacramento on December 16th, Roy scored 29 points despite knee and finger injuries. In the locker room after that game, Roy credited his teammates for the win.
Me and Coach talked earlier and he asked me how I think the guys are doing. And I said, I think they're good. So I think the good thing about it is nobody panics. I mean, you know, we had practice, we were loose, laughing, and I think we came out and we played that way tonight.
As a young team, we know that there's a lot of room for growth, and we don't ever want to be satisfied, so to speak.
Joe Prunty is an assistant coach for the Blazers. He's quick to point out just how young this team is. Every player, except for three, was born after 1983. Prunty says that's meant every day this team is learning, going over game tapes, practicing defense, learning the finer points of good basketball.
The West is extremely tough this year like it's been the last few years, and that's something for us as we continue to grow. We're going to have to know every night, you better bring it, because the West and even the team, the East has gotten better. There's going to be a good team going against you.
The Portland Trail Blazers are also working hard off the court, reconnecting with the fans that almost gave up on them. Players have handed out bikes to kids, taught basketball camps, and served meals to the homeless. That's gone a long way toward winning back longtime fans like Chuck Finnegan. He says he didn't go to too many games after the team hit rock bottom.
When they got the number one draft choice and they started they got Brandon Roy and Marcus LaMarcus and a few of the other players, nice kids, great attitudes, leadership-type qualities. It warranted coming back to the games at that point.
And Blazers fans have returned. This year, according to the NBA, they're third in total attendance. As one of the youngest NBA teams grows, players are already setting their sights on an NBA championship, something the Blazers haven't won since 1977. For Only a Game, I'm Sadie Babbitts in Portland, Oregon.
It's 19 minutes past the hour. Perhaps he was tired or feeling unwell. Whatever the reason, David Pratt, who normally goes 90 minutes for Chippenham in the UK, went just 3 seconds in a recent soccer game against Bashley before being red carded and sent off the pitch. In so doing, Pratt broke the record previously held by Bologna's Giuseppe Lorenzo, who was once red carded 10 seconds into a match. With regard to the miscreant, Chippenham secretary George McCaffrey said you could normally not meet a more milder man. Whether he meant a milder man or a more mild man was unclear. The match, played in Bashley Hants, was won by Bashley, though they were only able to bash in 2 goals despite enjoying a man advantage for 89 minutes and 57 seconds. I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, forget running through mazes. We'll hear about rats who lift weights, climb ropes, and hurdles. But first, The Crimson Tide was parted, or perhaps it merely ebbed, as Alabama fell to Utah 31-17 in the Sugar Bowl yesterday. Utah finished their season a perfect 13-0. In the Cotton Bowl, apparently both defenses rested, as Mississippi outlasted Texas Tech 47-34. Kentucky edged East Carolina in the Liberty Bowl 25-19. Joining me now to talk about college football's bowl season is Dan Wetzel of Yahoo Sports. Dan, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. Thanks for having me.
Texas Tech went 11-1 and was the only team to beat Texas, but Texas landed in one of the five bowl championship series games, while Texas Tech was left to face Mississippi in the non-BCS Cotton Bowl. If Texas Tech had beaten Ole Miss last night, could they have argued that they were robbed?
They were definitely robbed by the system. They were deserving of going to one of the BCS bowls. However, the BCS is about money and money only. So the issue is that no conference is allowed to have more than two participants in the BCS. The other leagues won't allow it to essentially take extra money out of the system. As a result, it's not about securing the five best games. It's not about rewarding the 10 best teams. It's about spreading the money around, as this cartel is very good at doing. So Texas Tech, as the third 11 or 12-1 team out of the Big 12, got the short end of the stick because it does not draw the fans or the television numbers that the traditional program Texas does.
The aforementioned Texas Longhorns will face Ohio State in the Fiesta Bowl on Monday night. The 11-1 Longhorns believe they should have been playing for the national title. Does Texas have a chance to beat the Buckeyes badly enough to make that case?
You know, the system is the BCS championship, and the system may be illogical. It may be mismanaged. It may be foolish. But Oklahoma defeated them by the standards of the system. The computers and the polls and all of that. And until, you know, you can say, well, the system isn't fair, that's fine, but you agreed to play in it. So I think whoever wins the game between Florida and Oklahoma is the champion. It's sort of like a gymnastics all-around meet when clearly the best gymnast maybe stumbles on one of the events and then wants to come back and say, well, we shouldn't weigh the scoring the way we do. So absolutely, they can make the claim they're better than Oklahoma. They beat them by 10 points on a neutral field. But they also agreed, this is how we're going to crown our champion. And guess what? This is how we're crowning our champion.
On Thursday, top-ranked Oklahoma will face number 2 Florida in the BCS championship game. The Sooners have this year's Heisman Trophy winner, the quarterback, Sam Bradford. The Gators have last year's Heisman Trophy winner, their quarterback, Tim Tebow. Safe to say this will be a defensive battle, right?
Yeah, they should move the ball a little bit here. Florida actually has a pretty good defense. Oklahoma has tended to give up some pretty big games, although their offense makes that really a moot point. This is an exciting matchup for people. I mean, obviously you have a lot of star power with Tebow and Bradford, and you have great coaching matchup with Bob Stoops and Urban Meyer. And it should be a high-scoring affair. There's a lot of great athletes. There's a lot of great NFL prospects on the field. And there's a lot of different ways to kind of exciting systems of offense that are going to be displayed, particularly Oklahoma's spread offense, which just scored more points than any college football team ever and routinely was knocking out 60 points a game. It's a little bit like basketball on grass. It's a sort of a crazy system, and we'll see if Florida can stop it. That's going to be the key to the whole game.
This afternoon, 8-5 Buffalo will face 7-5 Connecticut in the International Bowl in Toronto. Is this really the highest quality American college football we can ship north of the border?
Is this the world community doesn't already have issues with the United States? You know, we have 34 bowl games now. More football teams play in bowl games than basketball teams make the NCAA tournament. These things are just basically made for TV. I would not be surprised if the Canadian consulate, though, did issue a protest to the United States government, and I would not necessarily disagree with them.
Ball State and Tulsa will square off Tuesday night in the GMAC Bowl in Mobile, Alabama. Ball State was undefeated until its loss to Buffalo in the Mid-American Conference Championship last month. Will the Cardinals regroup to top off the best season in Ball State history?
And you wonder how GMAC needed a bailout when they're, you know, involved in such spectacular bowl games.
Yeah, my guess is if that hadn't come, they'd have to play in the dark.
Who would know? I actually think Tulsa's probably a better team. Ball State was playing in a you know, fairly weak league this year, the Mid-American Conference. The league is yet to win a single bowl game in, I think, three tries. So I actually would take Tulsa in that. And if you're watching, you probably have a problem. You know, this would be a good time to go reintroduce yourself to your wife and children or take up a hobby or something. I mean, look, I love the sport, but Tulsa, Ball State, that's, you know, this might be the line.
USC won its third straight Rose Bowl, beating Penn State on New Year's Day 38-24 in a game that was really close only in the first quarter. Both teams were once considered title contenders. How does USC stack up against the rest of the field?
USC is, the last few years, has had the most talent than anybody. They put a tremendous number of players into the NFL. It's a great system. When they're playing great, they look unbeatable. But each year they stumble to a lower-ranked team or lower-considered team, and then I think because most of the media is in the East, they don't play a lot on ESPN, they get overlooked because of that. Oklahoma has one loss. Florida has one loss also. USC has one loss. However, it was deemed by the popular vote that Florida's one loss and Oklahoma's one loss were less problematic than USC's one loss. So USC fans and Los Angeles, is every year there's a frustration with the system. They basically have to go undefeated or they have no chance.
Dan, there are more than two dozen bowl games already in the books. Were there any big surprises in the ones we haven't discussed?
Well, I'm not sure it's a surprise. I think a lot of people saw it coming, but the overall record of the Big Ten Conference is 1-5, and the five losses, none of them were really competitive losses, particularly USC just crushing Penn State in the Rose Bowl and kind of ruining everyone's New Year's Day again with a substandard opponent. So I think you're going to come out of the bowl game, the bowl season, again with more questions about the real overall quality of the Big Ten and why do they keep getting so many big-time games. The answer is because they have a lot of fans and they get TV numbers, but it's not bearing out in any way on the field.
Dan Wetzel covers college football, among other sports, for Yahoo Sports. Dan, thanks very much for joining me.
Thanks, Bill.
From the deep cold of a Midwestern winter comes the story of an exciting athletic event involving competitors that run, jump, climb, hurdle, and walk tight ropes and even pump iron. They're just like other athletes, except that they're white lab rats. Each year, hundreds of people come to Nebraska Wesleyan University to see the event, which was called the Rat Olympics until the USOC objected a few years ago, and which the psychology department feels is a valuable learning tool for its students. From Lincoln, Nebraska, Martin Wells reports.
The Extreme Rat Challenge is held in a large two-story room on campus filled with students, teachers, and spectators. Students line up to wait their turn to put their rats through their paces. Everywhere you look, rats are walking tight ropes, climbing walls, climbing ropes, jumping hurdles, and doing the long jump.
The longest I've gotten her to jump is about 26 inches. I wasn't originally going to do the long jump. It's just been the last couple of weeks I've been trying to do it, and she's doing very well.
That's senior Jenna Bonrenberger talking about her rat Trixie and all the training the two have been through together this semester.
I just, like, use the clicker to make this sound, and that usually stimulates her to know that there's a treat, and she'll take the treat out of my hand. But of course, she won't do it now. Right now, I'm just trying to get her used to the clicking sound so she's not scared of it.
The clicker training is the first step in the conditioning process in Dr. Marilyn Petro's basic learning class.
Well, basically, we're training the rats to perform different behaviors. And in order to do that, we have to both use classical training, classical conditioning, and operant conditioning.
If that sounds a little dry to you, you're not alone. Dr. Marty Klein, who originally taught the class, came up with the idea for this rodent competition back in 1974. He says he wanted to lighten things up.
Prior to this, I had a standard type of lab where people used little boxes, Skinner boxes, and pressed levers and got pellets. And I thought, you know, it might be reinforcing for the rats, but the students gets kind of old. So the idea was to make it fun so that people wouldn't need an external reinforcer to get them to do it.
Dr. Marilyn Petro currently teaches the basic learning class. She agrees with Klein that rat competition is a much better way to keep the students engaged while still teaching them psychology. Sophomore Kayla Hauk is working with her rat, Naja Jenta, which means good girl in Norwegian.
Because they're Norway rats, are derived from the Norway rat. And so I thought it couldn't hurt to be something in Norwegian.
Laura Roof and her rat Squirrel are working on the long jump. The rat is placed on a small platform, hears a click, and then is supposed to jump to the next platform. Each time the rat makes a jump, the platforms are pulled a little farther apart.
So how's your progress overall, would you say?
Some days are better than others, obviously. Some days Squirrel is very interested in the treats and very interested in training, and other days kind of lethargic and just not extremely into the training. So it depends on what day, but overall Squirrel's been doing really well. So.
And this is a pretty good day, you'd say?
Today's a good day, yeah.
There you go. Is that time?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
Oh, awesome.
On the day of the Extreme Rat Challenge, the students parade into the Great Hall with their rats on their shoulders. They're wearing lime green T-shirts that say Extreme Rat Challenge on the front. On the back, there's a picture of a rat walking a tightrope over the phrase, I walk the line. As the crowd cheers, Kayla looks a little nervous.
How's Naja Jenta doing on the big day here? Think she's ready to go?
Yeah, maybe. I don't know. We'll find out. Find out.
You don't sound real confident today.
Well, since we moved downstairs, she kind of has declined in how she was doing. So we'll see if she gets excited or not.
A panel of judges looks on while Kayla and Naja Jenta try the tightrope. Kayla places the rat on one end of the rope and holds a shaker in front of her to entice her to the other side.
Good girl.
She actually did pretty good today. She got a little bit distracted by the smells of the other rats, but that's normal, so.
Kayla says her rat's times were a lot slower on the wall climb, which consists of a 4-foot carpeted board leaning against a wall. Naja Jenta climbs the wall twice, once in 16 seconds and once in 11 seconds. Kayla says during practice she did it in as few as 5 seconds, but no medals for Naja Jenta today.
Well, Squirrel didn't do as well as the competitors, but Squirrel did pretty well for Squirrel, so we're pretty happy with how she did today.
Squirrel's best event was the lever press, where she came in fourth. Next, they try the long jump, but don't make it to the medal round. Jenna Bonrenberger and Trixie win 2 medals, a silver in the long jump and a bronze on the tightrope. At the end of the day, Dr. Petro praises the students for their athletic rats, and she gives them some insight on what it means to be a trainer or a teacher.
We see the challenges of learning, the challenges of training, you know, the heartbreak that can come when they don't do it, when you know they can. Remember, that's how your professors feel. When we see these scores sometimes, we go, no, we know they know this stuff. What's going on here?
Dr. Petro says by training their rats, the students themselves become better at teaching and learning because they understand the process. Sophomore Brooke Pernicek puts it this way.
To teach anyone or anything, you have to be patient with it, and you have to learn to make smaller steps, be patient, and you have to adjust it to fit the individual more than anything else. That is the main one, because I saw students who do very different techniques for training than I did, and it worked for their rat, but not mine. So that's why I got out of the class.
For Only a Game, I'm Martin Wells in Lincoln, Nebraska.
You're listening to Only a Game. It is late summer 2007. I take the luxury flight to Las Vegas, the one reserved for high rollers bound to lose vast amounts, the absence of which they will consider unremarkable. I stroll into the Strip's most opulent sports book. I suppose it has red flock wallpaper. In the background, I hear the gentle hum of televised horse racing. I can tell it is a class joint because the wailing of losers is muffled. Having remortgaged my house, cashed in my life insurance, rifled my children's college funds, and pawned my watch, my pockets are bulging with large bills. Still, I manage a nonchalance that suggests I know exactly what I'm doing. I remind myself a little of James Bond, as played by Sean Connery. A padded door toward the back of the room opens silently. Having recognized a potentially important client through his surveillance system, the manager of the bookmaking establishment advances toward me with his right hand extended. His fingers are encumbered by rings even bigger than the ones given to men who win the Super Bowl. I catch the man's hand in both of mine just before he would have tipped over onto the plush carpeting. "Thank you," he says, "and then how can we be of service?" We step into his paneled office, where I begin piling cash on his enormous mahogany desk. His eyes grow wide. "I want to bet this on a two-part proposition," I tell him. "For the first time since the NFL began playing 16 regular season games, one team will go undefeated." The manager tells me the odds he can give me on this development. They are exceptionally attractive. "But wait," I tell him, "there's more." His wide eyes begin to shine. "In the next season, for the first time ever, another team will go 0-16. The odds that this parlay will hit are, of course, preposterous. The man with the wide, shining eyes rapidly calculates that if he takes my bet and loses, he will be working for me. He dabs his forehead with a white handkerchief. He takes the money. How can he lose? Fast forward two NFL seasons. During one, the New England Patriots go 16-0. During the next, the Detroit Lions go 0-16. The headlines tell of falling markets, evaporating retirement funds, fortunes lost in a Ponzi scheme. This news does not lay a glove on me. It's 22 and a half minutes before the hour.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, where the program is produced. Reside, providing vintage home accessories, lighting, and furnishings by 20th century classic modern designers. Collections on view at resideinc.com. And Account Temps, a global provider specializing in temporary staffing of accounting and finance professionals, locations worldwide. Details at accounttemps.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The newspaper headlines the day after Vietnam clinched the Southeast Asian Soccer Championship, the country's first international title, with a 1-1 draw against Thailand, said it all. "Vietnam is invincible, unsurpassable," blared the front page of the Ho Chi Minh City Law. "Magical Vietnam," shouted page one of the newspaper People's Police. Hundreds of thousands of fans across the country celebrated in the streets, where they banged on pots and pans and waved flags all night long. But veteran Hanoi cab driver Nguyen Duc Thun was unmoved. "For Team Vietnam, sometimes there's sun, sometimes there's rain," he said. "When these players are gone, they won't necessarily be good anymore." I'm Bill Littlefield. Coming up on Only a Game, your second chance to read some of the great sports stories you missed the first time around. But first, I'm joined by Charlie Pierce for a look at the week's news. Hello, Charlie.
Hey, Bill, and hello to our new stations, WITF HD2 in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, WROG 93.3 FM in Chambersburg, Pennsylvania, WUKY 91.3 FM in Lexington, Kentucky. If you have a good horse, please send it along. And especially the eight stations of my son's new adopted home, Mississippi Public Radio.
Excellent.
Thank you. Folks around Square Books in Oxford can listen to us on their transistor radios.
Oh, this is an embarrassment of riches. Do we have any time left for questions?
No, let's just forget it. We'll introduce our new listeners. The fact that we don't do our jobs very well.
I'm going to soldier on. It being the NFL's wild card weekend.
Whee!
Do you have any wild or perhaps some tame predictions?
Not particularly, no. But I do think on Saturday, You're going to see the rare case of both road teams winning in an NFL playoff day. Atlanta will beat Arizona at Arizona, and I think Indianapolis is just going to do terrible things at San Diego.
Charlie, we probably don't have time to talk about all the NFL coaches who've lost
their
jobs.
Since there are a few.
There are some openings.
You could go 0-16 in Detroit, by the way.
I couldn't
and
go.
And do it cheaper than the guy they had.
I'd probably do it for a cool million. In any case, you want to pick one or two of those guys that probably maybe shouldn't have lost his job because it was the team's fault?
This will be contrary to everything you read in the New York tabloids, but I think firing Eric Mangini after three reasonably successful seasons is pretty terrible and is an indication of a front office in complete turmoil.
The Buffalo Bills lost 8 of their last 10 games this season. How did their head coach, Dick Geron, keep his job?
As near as I can tell from all the football pundits of my casual acquaintance, he kept his job because he's a really nice guy, and there really should be something to say about that.
Meanwhile, the latest football administrator to have arranged to receive millions of dollars even if he doesn't come to work is Bill Parcells. To be precise, he'll get $12 million if he elects not to continue on as the vice president of football operations for the Miami Dolphins. There's a Marx Brothers joke in there somewhere, isn't there?
Well, no, actually, it has to do more with the fact that Wayne Huizenga, the owner now, is selling the team. And Bill Parcells wants to work for Wayne Huizenga, doesn't necessarily want to work for owner X. So prior to taking the job down there, he left himself a $12 million out if Huizenga tells the team. This is very shrewd on his part.
Brett Favre, who came out of retirement to quarterback the Jets this season, will not need major surgery. However, does that necessarily mean he should keep playing football?
Well, if you ask me and several of his teammates, the answer is no. This was an unnecessary circus brought to town by the Jets, probably cost Eric Mangini his job, and probably is responsible for at least a decade of ill feeling around that locker room.
The University of Buffalo will play the University of Connecticut in today's International Bowl. This is the second time that Buffalo has been invited to a bowl game. The first time was 50 years ago, back in 1958. But this time, they'll have the opportunity to play.
Yeah, they were invited to the 1958 Tangerine Bowl, but there was a rule that barred black players from competing with white players. Buffalo chose not to compete in such a context. Good for them. And now they're getting the recognition they deserve. Also good for them.
Remember the Houston Comets? They won the first 4 WNBA championships because I guess that as of now, about all we can do is remember them.
Yeah, this is not a good thing. This was a signature franchise of the league, and now they're doing a lottery and a dispersal draft because the franchise is being shut down.
Is this, do you think, necessarily a harbinger of folds to come?
Unfortunately, I think it is, and anybody who thinks it's going to be restricted to women's pro basketball is deluding themselves.
The NHL's second annual Winter Classic drew over 40,000 fans to, wait for it, Wrigley Field on New Year's Day. I guess the hot dogs and the beer, probably a little colder than usual.
Not just, boy, it was cold out there yesterday, too, but it was good for them and good for the Blackhawks for having Bobby Hull and Stan Mikita and a bunch of old Blackhawks stars get up and sing a hockey version of Take Me Out to the Ball Game midway through the game.
I think
although 1, 2, 3 pucks, you're out, given the nature of cold weather and beer. That's living very dangerously close to the line on live television, if you know what I mean, and I think you do.
The Boston Celtics may add disgruntled New York Knicks Stephon Marbury to its talented roster. Are they taking a big risk by assuming Marbury will mysteriously become gruntled when he gets to put on a green jersey?
Well, I mean, he has played with Kevin Garnett before. If there's a vehicle for his gruntlement, it will probably be this. It's interesting to me that they're going for a reserve point guard, given the fact that, although Eddie House has proven not to be really a point guard, given the fact that Rajon Rondo is having an all-star caliber year, I thought they might do something about their front line, their rebounding problem that we saw on the West Coast. But we discover later that the Houston Rockets have re-signed Dikembe Mutombo, who seemed to be one of the Celtics' options.
Well, that was going to be the next thing I wanted to talk about. It is a good time of the year to remind our listeners that although Father Time usually wins, that is not always the case. You mentioned Dikembe Mutombo in Houston, and what about the San Jose Sharks?
Yeah, they brought back Claude Lemieux, probably the least likable player in the NHL, all the way from my hometown, Worcester Sharks. A little bit different now, he notices, in San Jose. Hey, this is a different place than Millbury Street. Very cool.
The aforementioned Celtics have not lost many basketball games this season, Charlie, but was that any reason for the Portland Trail Blazers to get to put 6 players on the floor against them on Tuesday night? Since when does basketball have power plays?
This is absolutely appalling, and the 3 referees, Mike Callahan, Rodney Mott, and Zach Zarba, should be suspended for a month because of this. Everybody saw the 6 guys. The people on TV saw the six guys. The people in the seats saw the six guys. Kevin Garnett saw the six guys. Unfortunately, they had the only refereeing crew made up of three guys who can't count to six.
Pat, son of Bob Knight, recently showed a certain flair for motivating his team. Is it fair to say he did so in a much more positive manner and a more entertaining manner than his dad would have?
His team was missing layups, so he pulled a 12-year-old kid out of the stands and had him hit a layup to show their kids, hey, look, you're 18 and 19. I got a 12-year-old kid who can hit layups. This strikes me as the legendary story about Al McGuire, who once had a one-eyed center named Pat Smith. Nickname was the Evil Dr. Blackheart. And Pat was there basically to throw elbows and rebound and play defense. He couldn't shoot. One night he shot miraculously well, beat DePaul, and Coach Ray Myers said, it's bad enough we have to lose to these guys, but we have to lose to them when their center can't throw the ball in Lake Michigan. The next day, Al McGuire, in the middle of February, had Pat Smith in his game uniform on the beach at Lake Michigan in front of the TV cameras, and he did indeed throw a basketball into the lake. It's good to know his spirit lives on.
And finally, Charlie, a man in Kennewick, Washington, thought he had found a new and productive way to use a paintball gun. However, local authorities said no. What was he trying to do?
He was trying to stop his friend from driving. Is this sports, by the way? I asked this. Our new listeners will note that I asked this from time to time. This guy isn't competing. He was trying to get his friend to not drive drunk. So when the guy got behind the car and tried to drive away, this guy peppered the windshield with paintballs.
I would think the police would give him a medal.
Well, apparently they think a designated driver would work well. A note to our new listeners, occasionally the boundaries of sport on this program, we span not only the globe, we span the other universes in Bill's mind.
Boundaries. Boundaries is a word with which I'm not familiar. Charlie Pierce writes for the Boston Sunday Globe magazine, and of course he joins me each week at this time on Only a Game as well. Thank you, Charlie.
Happy New Year, Bill.
Same to you. I'm just a humble radio host, born in the days when enraptured families sat together before the softly glowing Philco set. Your modern world of streaming media and MP3s frightens and confuses me, but that doesn't mean you have to feel the same way. To access podcasts of Only a Game, please go to onlyagame.org. Since 1991, Glenn Stout has been overseeing the collecting of the year's best sports writing and the publication of same by Houghton Mifflin. The guest editor of the 2008 edition is William Knack, who has eloquently written about Secretariat and various other winners. Glenn Stout joins me now from the studios of Vermont Public Radio. Hello again, Glenn.
Hi, Bill.
And we have Bill Knack on the phone as well. Bill, welcome back to Only a Game.
Thanks, Bill. Nice to be here.
Glenn, the bad news is that the economy is in a shambles. The NFL can no longer claim that on any given Sunday any team can win, and the Yankees are once again buying all the available good players. Have you some positive news about the current state of American sports writing?
Well, I think there is positive news, and that is that despite everything else going to hell in a handbasket, the writers still manage to keep finding wonderful subjects to write about and then just, you know, writing the bejesus out of them. And that's the kind of thing that I depend on each year.
Bill, as you looked over the stories that Glenn sent to you, was there one that you knew would make the cut as soon as you'd read the first paragraph?
Yeah, Scott Price's piece on the coach who got killed, Coolbaugh.
Mm-hmm.
And also the piece called Glory, written by Jean Marie Laskus. I thought, the minute I finished him, I thought this is an absolute must. But it was, I really threw myself into it and would wake up in the morning thinking about it, thinking about this piece as opposed to that piece. And, you know, when you're given 70 manuscripts, basically, and told that there's only room for 25, and when you start to get down to paring it down to 38, 37, 36, and you're starting to hit bone, the editing process is excruciatingly painful, and especially when you're dealing with the work of people that you know.
Of course, I enjoyed many of the stories in the book, but Bill, how did there happen to be so many tales about runners with only two legs?
Well, those were the ones that Glenn sent me. I didn't forage on my own very far, except for the piece that ran, the Dan Jenkins piece that ran in Golf Digest. Mm-hmm. I was looking for some humor.
Glenn, over the years, this collection has never lacked for poignance, but I've read few stories as sad as the account by Franz Lids of his brief visit with former Yankees boss George Steinbrenner.
Yeah, it is sad, and not just because you know, it's George Steinbrenner. It's one of the stories where you actually see Steinbrenner as a human being. And he's not a caricature anymore. He's actually this, you know, doddering, elderly man who's clearly not this vibrant personality that tortured all of us for so many years.
No, and he's no longer in charge. He's no longer in charge.
He's just another guy again. Mm. And there's something very sad and very poignant about that. You're not used to feeling sympathetic towards George Steinbrenner for anything. But I think one of the things that makes this story work is that you do feel sympathetic toward him because underneath everything else, he's, you know, in the same state that we're all going to be in.
Glenn, Bill mentioned the story Glory as one of the ones that jumped out at him. But I'm wondering, in these days when female athletes in women's sports are getting more attention than they once got, did you have any hesitation about sending along a story about cheerleaders, especially cheerleaders who worry excessively about their eyeliner and their hairspray?
You know, I really didn't. And I think the reason for that is because I think Jean Marie Laskus did a terrific job in that. At no time in that story does she look down at these women. At no time does she mock them. In many ways, I think she lets them stand for themselves. Now, you can argue with the merits of cheerleading, but I think it's kind of difficult to argue with the merits of these women cheerleading and living their lives the way they do. They seem quite self-aware about what they've gotten themselves into.
Plus, I thought the piece was beautifully written. She handled the material just really well. I was skeptical when I came to that story. I thought, what is she going to do to these women? And if she looks down at them or is in any way condescending or patronizing, this has no chance. That's too easy. But she actually created empathy. She mm-hmm. made you like the women. She made you wonder how they were doing. She made them real people. Mm-hmm. It created a very warm feeling about these women.
Glenn, I was happy to see that in your foreword, you mentioned one of my favorite writers. It'll come as no surprise to you that I feel that way about Bill Hines, who died in February, and you characterize him as one of the grandfathers of the Best American Sports Writing series. I know that Bill felt this annual collection was encouraging young readers. Did he ever tell you how he felt about your efforts?
Well, I know that he really appreciated the series. He wrote me a brief note one time. After he appeared in the Best American Sports Writing of the Century, the book that I edited with David Halberstam, I think he really appreciated the fact that good writing and good writers had a place again to be highlighted and honored and valued. And when I was a kid thinking about being a writer, 10, 12, 11 years old, reading stories by Bill Hines in the old Best Sports Stories anthology, that was very important to me. And one of the great hopes that I've had for this series ever since it started was that there are kids out there, and I know there are because now I speak to them sometimes and they're 30 years old and they call me sir and tell me they've been reading this book their whole life. But they tell me that, you know, reading this book when they were 12, 13 years old is something that made them want to be a writer. Now, given the current economic climate, that might not all be for the best. But, you know, it's very gratifying to hear someone say that. And I felt it was important in this book to, you know, give a nod to Bill Hines and also to David Halberstam, who we also lost in this past year.
You know, I thought that the pieces that really they all stood out. But I mean, I look for really thorough, detailed reporting. And given the blogosphere that we have entered into in the last 10 years, where a lot of guys just sit at their machines and do tap dances, it's really wonderful to come upon stories that are really well and thoroughly reported. Mm-hmm. And I was really happy to see, looking at the state of sports journalism, to see all of these stories that were just so thoroughly and beautifully reported, one after another. It showed extra effort in an attempt to detail people's lives and the state of the world in sports.
Bill, you talked about the fact that Glenn sent you some 70 stories out of which you had to pick 25. What was the process like? You talked about waking up thinking about certain stories.
You know, I'd never done this before, and so it was a new experience, and I decided to approach it by reading each piece thoroughly and then putting a grade on it, like I was a professor.
Mm-hmm.
And it went all the way up to when I put an A++++ on it. that was like the Scott Price piece or the Laskus piece. Mm. All I knew was when I looked at it the second or third time and I saw the A++++, I just set it aside. because I knew that was in. And the ones that were tough were the, you know, the B pluses, A minuses, and it was kind of an made me feel a little uncomfortable doing it that way, but that was the only way I could figure out doing it. I had to separate them, and some were simply better than others.
And who will take on the role of temporary English professor now that Bill Nack is passing it on?
The happy task awaits Lee Montville in about another 5 weeks. So I hope he's polishing his glasses.
And disconnecting his telephone.
Yeah, that's right.
Bill Nack is the guest editor of The Best American Sports Writing 2008, published by Houghton Mifflin. Bill, it was good to talk with you again.
Nice to talk to you, Bill, always.
And Glenn Stout has been the series editor since 1991. Glenn, always a pleasure.
Thanks a lot, Bill.
Only a Game is produced by Karen Given and Doug Trabu. Our technical director is John Ferrati, and our senior producer is Gary Wallach. If you dare to look at faster, higher, stronger rats, or you'd like to view Sadie Babbitt's Trailblazers photo gallery, download our weekly podcasts, or listen to stories past and present, please visit onlyagame.org. To order a copy of Only a Game, call 1-800-909-9287. CDs are $15. That's 1-800-909-9287. Our final word is from the winner of the 2008 Extreme Rat Challenge. Whoa, a dirty rat. Steroids, dirty rat. Get it? I'm Bill Littlefield. Thanks for listening. I'll see you next week.
Support for Only a Game comes from the listeners of WBUR Boston, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org. The Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And the William T. Grant Foundation, supporting research to improve the lives of young people, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.